Okay, good afternoon. I would like to welcome you to this conference given today by a very important doctor. The conference has been extended an invitation by the Department of International Relations here at the Tec de Monterrey. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest. Dr. Nancy Banks is a graduate of Hunter College and Harvard Medical School. As a senior medical student, she was awarded a scholarship from the American College of Surgeons to study surgery and tropical medicine at the Benin Medical College in Benin, Nigeria. She completed her internship and residency in general surgery and obstetrics and gynecology at St. Luke's and Mount Sinai Hospital and at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Banks also has a master's degree in finance from Pace University. And while she was practicing medicine in New York at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, she got very interested in what they were calling this HIV/AIDS pandemic. From then, it's a long story, but I will let you listen to her as she tells you about her experience. So without further ado, I proudly present to you Dr. Nancy Turner Banks.
Buenas tardes, damas y caballeros. Gracias por esta invitación a Tecnología de Monterrey. Quisiera agradecer especialmente a Cecil Romero, directora de la carrera de Relaciones Internacionales, y a su jefa, Delia Mosca, directora del Departamento de Negocios y Derecho de la Escuela de Negocios y Humanidades, y a mi tío, Mark Jones. That's all the Spanish for today. I hope you understood me. Great. I've been here for a year. I love Guadalajara. I love the Mexican people. It's been a great experience. And I'm going to teach you, I understand that most of you are in the undergraduate level, but this is going to be like a graduate level seminar. I'm going to treat you like graduate students, and when you leave the seminar today, you're going to know something about about globalization and about the money system and how money works in the global financial markets, probably better than 90% of the people on the planet. Because this, unfortunately, although the monetary system is probably one of the most important things that happens in the world, it's not generally taught in a way that really makes sense either at the undergraduate or the graduate level. So the title of my lecture today is The Deadly Virus of International Greed, Understanding the Meaning and the Consequences of Globalization. Is this? And this is, qui bono is an Italian word from the Latin. And when you see this word, I'd like you all to say, can you say qui bono? It means, are these words in Spanish? Because in Italian, it means who benefits. And so throughout the lecture, when I talk about things, I want you to think about who is benefiting from the processes that we're going to talk about. And of course, today, we may get into a little danger because thinking for yourself in today's world is a little bit dangerous. Now, just a little bit about me. I'm from the Midwest in the United States, from a state called Ohio. This is my high school, Warren G. Harding High School, where I attended. And when I attended high school in the United States, I'm part of what is called the baby boom generation. And at that time in the United States, there certainly were racial problems, but we did not have drugs, and the country at that time was very prosperous. When I was in high school, I was an exchange student, and I lived in the Netherlands with a Dutch family for a semester, which was a terrific experience. It was the beginning of me thinking about how the world works, because when I went to the Netherlands, it was maybe 2.5 decades after the end of the Second World War, and there were still burnt out and bombed out buildings. And for a kid from the United States going to Europe and seeing where the battles were and seeing some of the buildings that were still burnt out from the Second World War. It had a very profound effect on me, and it made me begin to really think about how we can have a more peaceful world. So after I finished high school, I actually, because of the civil rights movement in the United States, I got involved in the civil rights movement, and also it was during the time of the Vietnam War, and because I do not like war, these were things also that had a great impact on me, and I was fortunate enough at that time to meet Dr. King. Dr. King said, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetuate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating in it." And this is also part of the Nuremberg Code. After the Second World War, when the Nazi war criminals were put on trial and they said they were just following orders, unfortunately, the excuse that you were just following orders was not an excuse. Today, we see that many people are saying they're following orders, but I think there's always going to be a day of reckoning. I went to Hunter College in New York City. It's part of the City University of New York, where I majored in psychology and biology. I then went on to Harvard Medical School in Boston. After Harvard, I studied surgery and obstetrics and gynecology at Mount Sinai and at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is the premier cancer center in the United States. But as I started my practice, I really became a little bit disturbed because one of the things that I saw that I really wasn't trying to, I was taught how to give medications and drugs and how to operate, but I really wasn't taught how to keep people healthy. And that really began to disturb me, also because at that time in the United States, many people were beginning to ask about alternatives to the healthcare system. They were tired of taking the drugs, and they knew that many of the drugs had side effects, terrible side effects. For example, the other reason I got involved in thinking about how the world is functioning, other than in medicine, is because every time there's a macro or a microeconomic issue, it ends up in the doctor's office. For example, if there's the oil spill by BP in the Gulf of Mexico, there were a lot of chemicals, and so the people in the Gulf are very sick. Or there was the chemical spill in Bhopal at the end of the 80s, where thousands of people died, and the water is still polluted. And in the United States right now, they are beginning to explore for natural gas, and they are doing a process called fracking. And the fracking is when they're using pressure to put chemicals into the ground to be able to extract the gas. And unfortunately, those chemicals are toxic, and they're getting into the wells of the people, and the animals and the people are getting sick. So you can see that business decisions that damage the environment have consequences to people, and those people end up in the doctor's office. This is one of the reasons I went to the business school, because I knew that there was something about the way the economy was functioning that I didn't understand. And it was in business school that I first heard about something called fractional reserve banking. How many people know what fractional reserve banking is? Two. So 90%, it's maybe like 99%. So when you leave here today, you're going to be smarter than a lot of people, because fractional reserve banking is the way banking is done. And when you really find out what that means, you're going to be astounded. Because fractional reserve banking is the elephant in the room. It's the thing that really makes the world run. It's the thing that causes a lot of problems, yet it's the thing that most of us don't know anything about. This is, is this my pointer? I'm technologically not so smart. Okay, here it is. Yeah, Throughout the lecture, I'm going to recommend some books or some authors for you that really will, that I found absolutely fabulous. This book is easy to read. It's a big book, but it's probably the best book on money in banking. It's called The Lost Science of Money. Stephen Zaringa, I know the person who wrote this book, and it really explains in a very helpful way the history of the monetary system in the West and how we got to our banking system today. This is the book that I wrote, AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, The Deadly Virus of International Greed, because I wanted to look at, did I really understand what AIDS was, how did it come about, and how is it being portrayed? And what I found was very different than what is being taught. But this is a different lecture today, so we're not going to talk about my book, but we're going to talk about some other things.
No, this is not about making profit from weapon sales. It's about control.
Control the flow of weapons, control the conflict.
No. No, no. The IBBC is a bank. Their objective isn't to control the conflict. It's to control the debt that the conflict produces. You see, the real value of a conflict, the true value, is in the debt that it creates. You control the debt, you control everything. You find this upsetting, yes? But this is the very essence of the banking industry. To make us all, whether we be nations or individuals, slaves to debt.
So that was from the movie The International. And, sorry. And so basically what it's about an international bank, such as the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. And basically what he is telling these two actors is that the banks make money, although they do other things like launder money, but they also make money because of debt. And it's debt that has the whole planet in an uproar right now. These are scenes from Europe over the last year. This is Greece, Ukraine, Turkey, and London, where young people are losing their education ability because of the increasing cost of education, where the cost of food has skyrocketed, and people are losing their jobs in their homes. This is Brussels and Rome. This is Korea, Chile, Spain, and Ireland. And this is Occupy Wall Street in New York, where the mantra is, we are the 99%. Because the wonderful thing about the Occupy movement is that young people, almost all of these movements are young people, but the one thing about the Occupy movement, the young people are having teach-ins, and for the first time, in the United States, our students are saddled with so much debt, and right now they're having difficulty finding employment, that they are beginning to talk about why they have so much debt and what the banking system has done to them. And so the conversation has begun. And once a conversation begins, it's not going to stop. Whether people want it to stop or not, it's not going to stop. In the United States, at this time, we have the highest wealth inequality of any industrialized country. In 1970, our CEO pay to worker pay was 24-1. And by 2004, our CEO pay to worker pay was 500-1. From 1986 to 2006, the richest 1% of Americans tripled their after-tax income, while 90% dropped by 20%. So the middle class in the United States, the backbone and the stability of the United States has traditionally been the middle class, and the middle class in the United States right now is being gutted. And this wealth transfer has continued under both political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. And this is basically what these children are being told: consume, be silent, die. This is not a message that we want to give to our young people. Now, Mexico had a debt crisis in 1994. They had one in the 80s, and they had another one in 1994. Southeast Asia in 1997, and Argentina in 2002. So the question, again, people are of the planet need to be raising the question, why are sovereign nations in such debt? And the reason I raise that issue, because the sovereign nation has the ability to print its own money without borrowing it from a central bank. So we're, as the people of the planet, we're steeped in debt. So these guys, this G8 or G20, these guys get together, and so they talk about in 2008, what are we going to do because we're having this meltdown, this terrible financial crisis? And so who are we going to save? Are we going to save the people? Nope, they don't save the people. They save the banks. Cui bono? Who benefits? Well, this is Lloyd Blankfein. Lloyd Blankfein is the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is a financial bank in New York City, and it has been shown that Goldman Sachs really probably was the prime bank which created the financial crisis of 2008. How did that happen? In the United States, they were beginning to sell real estate to everybody. In the past, if you bought a house, you had to have a credit and a job and a down payment. And over the last few years, they were giving loans to people who really should not have had loans. At the same time, the economy was beginning to slow down. So Goldman Sachs and other large banks packaged these mortgages and sold them into the domestic and the international market. However, they knew that the mortgages were not AAA. As a matter of fact, they even bet against their own mortgages that they were selling to people, knowing that the mortgages were, that they were called mortgage-backed securities. They knew that those mortgages were going to fail. And so people all over the world, in Europe, in the United States, bought these securities and they put them in their banks. These securities were allowed to be part of what is called the reserves. But if you buy a security and you think it's worth $1 million, but it turns out to only be worth $1,000, your reserves dwindle and your bank could fail. And so all of this money that they have been spending has not been going to the people who were losing their homes. It went to the banks because they made a bad bet. Now, in my book, I was taught that in a capitalist system, if you make a bad business decision, your business fails. But unfortunately, in our system, if you make a bad business decision and you're a bank, you get bailed out by the taxpayers. And that's basically what has been going on both in Latin America, North America, and in Europe. So the demonstrators went to jail and the Wall Street bankers got bailed out. This is another friend of mine who wrote a book called The Web of Debt. It's another book that I do recommend. It's a good book that talks about not only the Federal Reserve and the banking system, but Ellen gives ideas for how we can begin to work our way out of this system. And this is going to be, you know, they always tell young people, it's up to you. Well, unfortunately, it is up to you. But if you don't know how the system works, you can't even think about how you're going to get out of the system. So I'm giving you a heads up today. So this is the interesting thing about the fractional reserve system. I gotta put my glasses on. And this is the thing that blew my mind once I understood it. If you have under the fractional reserve system with a 10% fractional reserve, what this means is that if you're a bank, you only have to have 10% in the bank of what you lend to your customers. For example, if you have $100 in your reserves, you can lend out $900. Where did that $900 come from? It was created out of thin air. The banks have no money. They only have these reserves. They create money out of thin air. And then what do? They charge interest on the money that never existed. They charge interest on money that doesn't exist. And so that's why the world is in debt. And there's no way to get out of this debt as long as the system is in place. So that if you have $1,000, you can create $9,000 without any leakage, potentially $9,000, which you can charge interest on. And that's the current banking system. So this is how the money becomes devalued. And that's one of the problems. That was one of the problems with the peso in 1994. And that's one of the problems with the dollar. And that's one of the problems with the euro right now. It's becoming devalued as a result of this leak. So Thomas Jefferson, one of our third president, I believe, stated, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. And as a matter of fact, you know, many people say, you know, they talk about the Boston Tea Party as the start of the American Revolution, but the American Revolution really was a revolution against the banking system. And the people who fought the revolution knew about the banking system. And it's one of the reasons why it was written into our Constitution that the Congress, which was elected by the people, should have control of the monetary system, which they gave away in 1913 to the Federal Reserve. And as you can see, the rate of inflation since the institution of the Federal Reserve has skyrocketed, and the value of the dollar has gone down significantly. Cui bono, who benefits? Usury is a word that we don't talk about much anymore, but I want to just talk about how some people through history, and sometimes we have to go back to the older people who tried to teach us that we sometimes don't listen. But this is what Aristotle had to say about usury. The most hated sort of wealth getting, and with the greatest reason, is usury, which makes a gain out of money itself, and not from the natural object of it. For money was intended to be used in exchange, but not to increase at interest. And this term interest, which means the birth of money from money, is applied to the breeding of money because the offspring resembles the parent. Wherefore, all modes of getting wealth this way is most unnatural. St. Thomas Aquinas noted that money was invented chiefly for the purpose of exchange, and consequently, the proper and principal use of money is its consumption or alienation, whereby it is sunk in exchange. Hence, it is by its very nature unlawful, to take payments for the use of money lent, which payment is known as usury. And just as man is bound to restore ill-gotten goods, so he is bound to restore the money which he has taken in usury. Because the ancient world understood that the creation of debt unbalanced society, and it led to disharmony. And that's what we're seeing with all of these riots around the planet right now. Pope Benedict XIV, 267 years ago, issued the Vix Pervenit. He said the problems Pope Benedict identified with usury and other, he called them dishonest profits, included avarice, unfeeling attitudes, burglary, buccaneering, cruelty, commandeering, depredation, pillage, plunder, and piracy. These were harsh words from the Pope. But we will examine some of the fruits of this debt usury system and see if these words are indeed harsh. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, why does money come into existence as debt? Because money is just a medium of exchange. For example, if I decided that this bottle of water, if we collectively decided that bottles of water were the medium of exchange, we could collectively use bottles of water for the medium of exchange. Because the money arose out of the need for people not to have to carry things. For example, if you have sheep and someone else has a cow and you want to exchange your sheep for a cow, sometimes it was too cumbersome. So it was easier to use something that was small to say, okay, I'll buy your cow rather than, you know, exchanging the sheep. And so money was basically put into existence as a medium of exchange. Money was never brought into existence to be something that grew, because the only things that have a natural life can grow, and money doesn't have a natural life. And that is why debt is weighing the planet down, because there's nothing natural about the life of debt. So why do we pay compound interest on an asset, a dead asset that never existed? Again, who benefits? This is called fractional reserve banking. Now, the story of fractional reserve banking, any five-year-old could really understand this, and it's not complicated, and this is the deal. If you put 10 marbles into a tin can, you cannot get 11 marbles out. And this is what the banking system does. We put 10 marbles into a tin can, and we want 11 marbles out. And the problem is that the banks go around the world, and they say, we put 10 marbles in, but we want 11 back. So they say to Greece, you owe us that 11th marble, but Greece doesn't have the 11th marble. In the 1994 debt crisis, Mexico didn't have the 11th marble. In 2002, Argentina didn't have the 11th marble, because the 11th marble is actually fictitious. It's the fake money that the banks make that they charge interest on. So this is how we have the consolidation of global powers, and this is what now is called globalization. And the globalization is the result of the first two world wars, because when they teach you about the world wars, in the First World War, they talk about Archduke Ferdinand, and who knows, who cares about Archduke Ferdinand? The end of the First World War, several years after that war, the first international bank was created. It was the Bank for International Settlements. It's in Basel, Switzerland. There are 150 central banks in the world, and every head of the central bank meets in Basel, Switzerland, to find out what the policies are going to be globally. For example, our Federal Reserve chairman flies there about 10 times a year. And whoever is head of the Bank of Mexico probably does the same thing. After World War II, before the peace treaty was even dry in the end of the war, 700 or more people met in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and they developed the World Bank and the IMF. Almost every country is now indebted to these banks. Now, I'm just briefly going to talk about, because this is not a discussion about narco trafficking, but the thing that you have to understand is the role of narco trafficking to the international financial community. And the reason why we're not going to see an end to the drug war anytime soon. Of course, most of you probably know about the recent scandal. It's in the United States, it's called Fast and Furious, in which the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms was caught running guns into Mexico. Now, as recently as yesterday, Colombia's former president calls America's war on drug a failure. But the war on drug has not been a, the war on drug is a failure for most ordinary people because it has decreased the quality of life. If you go into America's inner cities, when a generation ago, you could walk around the streets of those cities, you could send your kids to a store to get a popsicle and they could come back safe. Now, you turn off your lights and close your doors. And the same thing is happening in places in Mexico as well. Because the quality of life, when drugs come into a society, the quality of life begins to fall for the general population. Recently, Vice President Biden came to Central America because the heads of several of the Central American states raised the issue of the legalization of drugs because of the terrorism that's going on in these communities. But the United States does not want the drugs to be legalized. They've legalized drugs in Portugal, and they found that it has worked out satisfactorily for them. Their crime has gone down, and the number of addicts have actually gone down. But why do they want the flow of drugs? You have to understand that the drug industry is one of the biggest industries on the planet. It's 6 to 8% of the global economy. It's bigger than the automobile industry, all the automobile industries of the entire globe. It's a big business. And it's money that goes into the banks. This is Richard Grasso. He was the former head of the Security and Exchange Commission in New York, responsible for overseeing the stock market, and he's meeting in Colombia with the head of the FARC guerrillas. Why? Because that money can go into the banks. That money is very important for the banks. How important is it? Well, during the financial crisis of 2008, the UN, the executive director of the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, Antonio Maria Costas, said that he had seen evidence that the only liquidity in capital markets was drug money. That's how important drug money is to the banking system. So we've got to begin to think our way out of this system. It's destroying our communities. Now, one of the things that why do I have the Queen here? Because when I started looking at the drug history, the drugs were not, every culture has always used some sort of drug. There's not a culture on the planet that you go to that doesn't have alcohol or drug or something that they've used. But it's always been part of the society, and it's never been an addictive process. It did not become a commodity for exchange until the British East India Company fought two wars with China. They fought two wars called the Opium Wars to push drugs into China. And since that time, drugs have been a part of the global economy. If you really want to know how the drug money works, and this is not a lecture on that, this woman is Catherine Austin Fitz. She has a website called Solari. She used to be a banker on one of the major Wall Street firms called Dillon and Reed, and she was also the undersecretary of the Housing and Urban Development Authority in the United States. She is a financial genius. She now works with ordinary people and tells them how they can protect their assets in a parasitic economy. She's written two great articles. If you want to know more about how narcotics works as a how it's financing the system, she wrote Narco Dollars for Dummy and Narco Dollars for Beginners, and both of those articles can be found on the internet. Who benefits?
Who are the new rulers of the world? Their empire today is greater than the British Empire ever was. This is the center of this new empire, all within a square mile in Washington. Down the road from the White House and the US Treasury is the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These two bodies are the agents of the richest countries on earth, especially the United States. The World Bank and the IMF were set up near the end of World War II to rebuild the economies of Europe. Later, they began offering loans to poor countries, but only if they privatized their economies and allowed Western corporations free access to their raw materials and markets.
Debt has really been used as an instrument in order for the IMF and the World Bank to get their policies implemented in many developing countries. And we're into a situation now where the poorest countries are in a cycle, a vicious cycle of poverty. They can't get out. And the kind of debt cancellation that's been given still will not allow them to get out of this poverty trap. It's not a question of debt forgiveness, because actually many of the debts were incurred under pressure from the international institutions or were given in collusion with governments which weren't acting in the interests of their people.
Let me ask you, do you know the difference between Tanzania and Goldman Sachs? Tanzania is a country that has a gross national product of $2.2 billion and shares it between 25 million people. Goldman Sachs is an investment firm which has annual profits of $2.2 billion and shares them among 161 partners. That's the world we're living in now.
The World Bank says its aim is to help poor people, promoting what it calls global development. It's an ingenious system, a kind of socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. The rich get richer on running up debt, cheap labor, and paying as little tax as possible, while the poor get poorer as their jobs and public services are cut back in order to pay just the interest on debt owed by their governments to the World Bank. Here in Indonesia, where most people are poor, the handouts to the rich have been extraordinary, to say the least. Internal documents of the World Bank confirm that up to a third of the bank's loans to the dictatorship of General Suharto went into the pockets of his cronies and corrupt officials. That's around $8 billion.
That was from a movie that's a little dated because Suharto hasn't been in Indonesia for about 12 or 13 years, but that's John Pilger. He's a British journalist, but basically the evidence that he was presenting hasn't changed much in terms of how the World Bank and the IMF do business. Now, this is, with the hat, is Greg Palast. He's also a journalist. He's an American journalist, but he works for the BBC. And on the right, your right, is Joseph Stiglitz. Joseph Stiglitz was at one time an economist for the World Bank, and he has won a Nobel Prize in economics. So when Stiglitz talks, he knows what he's talking about. And he had an interview with Greg Palast where he talked about how the World Bank and the IMF defined their loans and how they wanted their loans paid back, and they call them conditionalities. So this is the idea that the banks can come into a sovereign state and tell that state how the state should run itself internally. And there are four, actually there are four steps, four and a half steps. The first step to a loan repayment is called privatization. And this is when the state, they ask the state to sell off any private industries, for example, water or gas. If you recall, several years ago in Bolivia, they had, I think it was riots because they were trying to sell the water system. So this is because as soon as they sell the assets to a private company, the cost to the ordinary citizen goes up terrifically. Step two is called capital market liberalization. And in capital market liberalization, this allows capital to flow in and out. And this is a really, if you're trying to protect your country, this is something that unfortunately happens too often. The capital market liberalization, where investment capital can flow into your economy and create bubbles. But when the bubbles are about to burst, the investment capital flows out, and that's when your currency is devalued, and that's when you get into these problems. In the currency crisis in Southeast Asia, the only country that didn't really develop this problem was Malaysia. And the reason Malaysia was able to protect itself is because they actually, the IMF said they were going to give them money, but they delayed for about 6 years. And after about 6 years, their economy picked up, whereas Japan's economy is still having problems, and some of the other, Thailand and some of the other countries in Southeast Asia. So the thing that happened in Malaysia is that they actually almost outsmarted the World Bank, but they were also lucky because they still had trading partners in the area. So if you're working in your government, if you're working for the bank, and these are the conditions, you have to understand that sometimes you have breathing room to negotiate so that your country does not become oppressed by more debt. The step three is called market-based pricing, and that's market-based pricing basically means that the cost of food and water and the kinds of things that people need to survive skyrocket. And then step three and a half, because of these increasing prices, they know that people are going to protest, and that's what we're seeing all around the planet right now, these protests. They call it the IMF riot, but it's not generally a riot. It's generally people protesting because the quality of their life has deteriorated. And then, of course, step four, they call it the poverty reduction strategy, but basically, it's free trade by the rules of the World Trade Organization, and that means that the countries involved, for example, will have to take products from the north, whereas they may already have those products in their country. For example, what happened with NAFTA. After NAFTA, almost 2 million small farmers in Mexico lost their farms as a result of grain products from the north coming into the south. And so one of the goals, I think, of any country is to protect its people. And unfortunately, these trade agreements sometimes are not constructive for the people of the countries in which these trade agreements, who have to suffer through these trade agreements. And the other problem is, of course, with the bank, especially we've seen this in Africa, is a lot of kickbacks. The bank, you know, they have these what they call dictators, but the dictators are useful because the dictators will actually allow the World Bank or the IMF to come into the countries and to do their projects. The other problem with a lot of the, especially the big projects like the dams or the construction projects, many of them don't really benefit the ordinary people, but they are left with the expenses of paying for these things back. Who benefits? Cui bono? Well, if you saw the movie Avatar, most of you have seen the movie Avatar, and basically the movie Avatar was sort of a movie that was talking about how business, unfortunately, how large corporations sometimes are doing business without protecting the environment and without an idea that the environment or the people who live in an area should be protected. And again, this is how I got involved in these ideas, because if a corporation is polluting the environment where people have to fish or to eat or to live, those problems end up in the doctor's office. So we're just going to talk a little bit about Africa, because Africa right now is probably being recolonized. You don't really see very much good things on television about Africa, but there are some good things. They want it to look as if Africa is not able to manage itself, but we're going to talk a little bit about Somalia and we'll see how that may not be true. Africa is a huge continent. You never really see how big it is. It's 30 million square kilometers. The United States, Argentina, India, Western Europe, and China can fit into the continent. So when you see Africa on a map, you never really see how big the continent actually is. And the continent is resource rich. As a matter of fact, most of you probably have cell phones or computers, and one of the things that comes out of the Congo is something called coltan. And you cannot make your cell phones or your computers without coltan. And Africa's still suffering from the slave trade, which destroyed many communities, and also from the period of colonization, and also now with the banking colonization. So the first world has been dumping their garbage into parts of Africa. And this is the story of Somalia. Probably over the last year, you've heard about the Somali pirates. They've been in the news. They call them pirates. But let's talk a little bit about Somalia and why they call it a failed state. First of all, you notice that Somalia has the longest coastline of any country in Africa. It also is on the Gulf of Aden, in the Arabian Sea, in the Indian Ocean. 70% of all ships on the planet go through this channel, this Red Sea Gulf of Aden channel. So it's a vital, one of the reasons there's so much problems in this area right now, because geographically this is one of the important areas in the world for trade. And also because of where Somalia is located, its natural trading partners would be, and this part of Africa, their natural trading partners, of course, would be India and China. But the West wants to keep these countries in its sphere. However, after Somalia got its independence in 1960, by 1969, it had a coup, and it had a strong man who stayed there for almost 30 years. And they were under the influence of communist Russia. And it was a very, at that time, the country became very oppressive. People were limited in traveling, and the gross domestic product of the country, which was low, became even lower. So by 1990, that government fell apart, and essentially Somalia was what they call a failed state. But we're going to look at Somalia, because Somalia is not really a failed state. Somalia is a state which doesn't have a central bank. And for some reason, they have managed, even though it's still not a prosperous country by any means, they have managed without a central bank to have an economy and an international trade. Now, one of the things that happened with these pirates is this. When Larry Summers, if I can find Larry Summers, there's Larry Summers, when he was an economist for the World Bank, Larry Summers wrote a memo, and basically he said in that memo he thought it would be a good idea to dump waste products into Africa, because Africa was, quote, underpolluted. Shortly after that memo, the companies, two companies, a Swiss company and Italian company, began dumping toxic waste off the coast of Somalia. The fishing trawlers from other countries also began to overfish the waters. And fishing is one of the ways people survived in that country. Now, the toxic waste, people began to notice that the people who lived along the shore were getting sick. But after the tsunami in 2005, huge containers began to wash up on shore. And those containers contained toxic waste from hospitals, uranium, and other kinds of chemicals. Within a short period of time, 300 people had died. And so the tribal areas began to form militias that began to go out and try to stop these ships from dumping these toxic waste into their waters. And that's their version of a navy. So the West wanted to continue dumping toxic waste into their waters, and the United States sent the Navy SEALs over there to capture some of these pirates and to protect those waters to allow the dumping to continue. But what has happened with Somalia? The truth of the matter is that Somalia continues, compared to some of the African countries, has actually done better without a government than with a government. Their life expectancy has improved since they haven't had a government. Their one-year-olds that are immunized have increased. Their one-year-olds who are immunized against TB have increased. The number of physicians per capita have increased. The infants with low birth weights have decreased. The infant mortality has gone down. The maternal mortality rate has gone down. The access to health facilities have gone up. Extreme poverty has gone down. People have more radios, more telephones, more TVs, and the deaths from measles have gone down. The only thing or worse were the adult literacy and the combined school enrollment, because all the money that came into the country from the NGOs in the past went to schools. And so they still have schools, but not as many of the kids are going to schools. How do they continue to have trade? Because even without a bank, they kept the same money, because they saw the money as with that value. So the people still use the money, but the money doesn't come into existence with debt. And so, in fact, the country is doing better than some of the countries in the area because they don't have a central bank and the money hasn't come into existence as debt. So Somalia, as taking a second look at Somalia, people say, from one point of view, it's a failed state because it doesn't have a government or a central bank. But on the other hand, the people of the country seem to be able to carry on trade both domestically and internationally without a central bank. So what do we need to begin to consider? And what does your generation need to consider? The things that I think that it's time to focus on is we need to begin to think about how we're going to end the debt-based monetary system. The countries will always trade, but they must be free to make their own trade agreements based on the needs of their constituents, and not interest payments to central banks and the growth needs of the most powerful countries. And the thing that we're looking at in the United States, because so many things have, you know, the United States started out with separate states and separate states that were sovereign. And so much of the power has been taken from the states to the central government. And people are looking how to remove that power from the central government and get it back local. Because when you have power locally, you can have a little more transparency. And so those are the discussions that people are beginning to have. How do we have transparency in government? How do we have transparency in our banking system? And how do we exercise control locally? And one of the things Catherine Austin Fitz is doing is actually going around the country teaching people how they can use their money locally, to invest in businesses locally rather than, you know, going to the Walmarts or the mega stores of the planet. The Money Masters, again, if you want to have a good video, which is on the internet, to talk about how money works and how we can get out of the debt-based system, The Money Masters is a great little movie. It's about an hour. So the question is, can we free our minds? And that's, you know, that's, unfortunately, you know, it's like the generations before leave a mess and they say to you, okay, time to clean it up. But the only way you can clean up a mess is to know what the mess is. And today I hope I've given you some ideas about what the debt-based monetary system is, why it will always draw money away from one sector to upward to another sector because of this compounding of interest. But we can find some joy in all of this because if we free our minds, we can begin to laugh at this system and begin to think about how to create a new one. Because we, as humans, we have hearts and minds, and we can put those together to begin to solve the problems of the planet. One of the things we're learning, and one of the things being so great about being alive today is because, you know, we're beginning to learn to how much we don't know. And in astrophysicists, the astrophysicists have told us that 98% or more of the universe we haven't been able to measure. So that means there are so many things, not only in our world, but in the universe, that we're going to be discovering over the next century. And so you people have a lot of interesting things that are going to be happening. The other thing in medicine we're learning, we used to think that the DNA was the controlling mechanism. And what we're learning is that the organism, it's something called epigenetics, that the organism immediately responds to the environment. That they used to think we had 90% of our DNA was not used. But that 98% of the DNA is there. It's our historical memory of our time on this planet. So whenever there's a new experience or an old experience that perhaps hasn't happened before, our DNA is able to respond. It's an amazing kind of thing. And so we're learning that the DNA is sort of like the central processing unit, but it needs input from the environment. And even our thoughts can now, we know that how we think can alter our DNA. And actually, there's a scientist, she's a neuroimmunologist called Candace Pert. She calls them molecules of emotion, because when we have happy thoughts, we have happy molecules, and when we have sad thoughts, we have sad molecules. So our thoughts can even control how our DNA expresses itself. We're part of a very massive universe, and I think we have to stop thinking as if we're just little people who cannot possibly get our way out of the situations that we found ourselves in. We live on a planet. This is a map. It's called the Dymaxion projection map. Buckminster Fuller was probably one of the most brilliant intellectuals of the 20th century. And basically, he did this map to show us that we live on an island. Planet Earth is an island. We're all connected on this planet. We're not separate little states. We're basically connected, and it's a landmass surrounded by water. That we have to protect our planet, and we have to think about ways that we can protect our planet because it's the only one we have. It's beautiful. It's powerful. So this is the wisdom of the first people who basically say that we are powerful and the power comes within us. They called it the Great Spirit. The Great Spirit is within us. And joy and imagination are innately who we are. And we may feel like kittens, but in fact, we are lions. Thank you. If anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to take any questions. About the banking system, yes? Is there another microphone? Because then you're going to have to run back and forth. He has a mic.
Control?
Right.
Hello? And so I think if we go back to the 90s, is it the same principle of what happened to Iraq and Libya? Because I studied under Saddam Hussein's lawyer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the 90s, Saddam wanted to stop trading in dollars.
And that's when he was attacked.
Right. And then what happened to Gaddafi, I believe Gaddafi.
That's when he was attacked. Because the clash of civilizations is a clash of banking systems.
And I believe Gaddafi wanted to create a gold dinar, right, which would be independent of the Western
right.
system. And so, is that pretty much what's going on? And
this has been, you know, one of the things I write about in my book is Patrice Lumumba. Patrice Lumumba was the first elected president of the Congo. And Patrice Lumumba and Kwame Nkrumah, who was the head of Ghana at that time, had a secret pact, and they were going to form a Pan-American Union. They were going to have a single currency, and they were going to have a strategy for protection, an army that was going to protect. And they were eventually going to have other people, other countries come into that African Union that would be controlled by Africans so that they could use their resources for their own people. And of course, Patrice Lumumba was assassinated with a combination of the CIA and the Belgians. And Kwame Nkrumah was at a coup d'etat, and he was thrown out. And mostly it was because from the 1970s, the policy of the United States and NATO countries has been that they feel that they want to have access to the resources of Africa for use for Western corporations.
And so I guess this Kony deal is just a natural progression of...
Well, Kony, first of all, Kony is no longer... Kony is a propaganda piece because, you know, you can't keep saying everybody is terrible, so the new strategy for military aggression is humanitarian. Kony was operative maybe 15 years ago. He is no longer operative in that area. The Kony is was in Uganda. He had something called the Lord's Army, and apparently they took children and, you know, raped women, and they were a nuisance. But the problem is you have to look at who's heading Uganda, because it's Museveni, and Museveni has been instrumental in the Rwandan crisis. And so who is the problem? Is it Museveni or is it this Kony? But within a few days of that movie coming out, the Kony 2 2012, the young people had already debunked that as a propaganda piece, and the guy who produced it was found on the streets of San Diego naked. He had a nervous breakdown. So the whole Kony story fell apart within a few days. And that's the beauty of the internet, and that's the beauty of your generation, because you guys talk to each other all over the planet. And when governments are lying to you, it's like you're so much more aware than we were. It's amazing. I am so amazed and impressed by the young people today. It's like you blow me away. It's amazing.
Just one final question. You mentioned Dr. King, and one of my favorite quotes from him was that, "A man not willing to die for something is a man not fit to live." And are you aware of the 1999 court case, the court verdict by the King family, which
The whole thing. Yeah, I know because they don't talk about it, but I knew that it wasn't true for a long time. Many people did.
It's just something I learned last year. So that they found government agencies responsible for his assassination.
I think our governments do wonderful things, but there are some people sometimes in our governments who don't do wonderful things. And I think that our responsibility is of citizens is to do our best to try to bring these people to justice. It's difficult, but for example, Dick Cheney just recently canceled a trip to Canada because the Canadians don't want him there. Henry Kissinger, there are many places on the planet where he can no longer go. He canceled a trip to France a few years ago because the French don't want him there. And there is an international criminal court, and it functions not well. The people who usually are brought before the court are low-level dictators, generally in developing countries. But that court is there, and it's going to function. Anybody else? Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. I hope this was just a beginning. Now you know more about the financial system than 99% of people on the planet. Most people don't know what the fractional reserve system is. They don't know how they create money out of thin air. They don't understand why the world is drowning in debt. The world does not have to be drowning in debt. This is a system that was created by men. It's a system that can be uncreated by men. So it's time for us to start thinking about how we're going to get out of this debt system. And how, as I said, Somalia, they're trading with a currency that has value. And the government, the people there print the currency, and they consider it has a unit of value. So you can have money that doesn't have to come into existence as debt, that can have a unit of value. The bankers, however, don't want this, and they will fight. Believe me, it will be a struggle. It's not going to be easy. Do you have a question? Oh, okay. In the back?
Do you think it's like a possibility to have like a third world war with this economical crisis if we don't do anything to stop this debt and everything, or?
Well, one of the things that has happened, for example, when there's a lot of debt, the bankers they promote war as a response to debt. Because it unfortunately creates more debt, but once you have this destruction, then you have to build things up again. And so once the war is over, there's a building process, and that building process allows the bankers to continue to gain wealth. I am hoping right now, I see in my country that they are really trying to push for war with Iran. But no, the majority of people in the United States do not want war. They're tired of war. We've been at war for the last 11 years, and it's going nowhere. And our kids are coming back in body bags, and basically we're tired of it.
Okay.
So unfortunately, we have some very powerful pressure groups in the United States that want war. I'm hoping that these pressure groups are exposed because they're not sane. They're not sane. Anybody who thinks that we could just attack Iran and there won't be repercussions has to be a little bit nuts.
Thank you.
What do you think about backing up our monetary system with silver and gold?
Well, silver and gold are just other, the thing about silver and gold, it doesn't matter. it doesn't matter what you have your money monetary system with. For example, in Great Britain at one time, I think it was King James, I don't remember exactly, they used sticks. They called them tally sticks. And they were just trees, and they were sticks that they cut in a particular pattern, and then you could put the sticks together. And the reason they could use them is because the government allowed you to pay taxes with those tally sticks. Money can be anything you want it to be. And it doesn't have to be silver or gold. It could be, you know, when the British first came to the United States, the first world people were using shells. They called them wampum. And the Europeans would trade with the first world people with wampum until they started making their own currency. So currency can be anything you want it, as long as people agree that it has a unit of value. And that's what I, and that's why the book that I showed you, the History of Money, is so important, because he really makes that clear. He really talks about what money is. So money doesn't, it could be anything that a group of people decide has value in terms of their exchange rate, and that you can agree on what the exchange rate is, and that you can do business locally and internationally with that currency.
Okay, thanks.
Dr. Banks, the groups that you were talking about that were trying to get into war with Iran, are you talking about the Jewish lobby in the United States?
Yeah, it's a very powerful lobby in the United States. It's very powerful. And they have a group, they published a paper about 11 or 12 years ago called The Project for the New American Century. And you can see that paper online. And in it, they really talked about the strategy that they wanted to develop for the United States going forward in terms of the wars that they anticipated. And then one of our generals, whose name escapes me right now, actually Wesley Clark, basically said publicly that they announced, he told the countries that they wanted to attack over the next few years. But most of these countries, first of all, these countries are oil rich. They have some of them had Islamic banking, which forbids usury. And they are in an area which, as you can see, is strategically important, not only because of its wealth, but because of its geographical location in terms of trade, especially with trade with Southeast Asia. So these are spheres of influence. Zbigniew Dobrynski wrote about this in his book, The Tektronic Era, any number of years ago. But basically, that area, that sort of what they call the Middle Eastern area, is a very important, not only for where it's strategically located, but for the natural resources.
I mean, I'm half Israeli, so I know that we also have interest in destroying Iran. So.
Yeah, but a lot of the Israelis are, you know, let me say this. You don't have to be Jewish to be Zionist, and you don't have to be a Zionist to be Jewish. Many Jewish people do not want war. And in the United States, there's a very large group of Jewish people who are anti-war, and they understand that, and they think that Israel could be safer if it learned how to be at peace with its neighbors. And I tend to agree.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Who are the persons that wins when the economy goes down and in the war?
Well, let's look at it. For example, when the economy went south in the United States in 2008, and people were losing their jobs and they were losing their homes, the taxpayers were asked for billions of dollars for a bailout of the banks. That money did not go back to the taxpayers, nor did it soften the blow or allow the banks to stop foreclosing on homes. So that money, which was public money, was transferred to private firms. So firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan, and the huge financial institutions profited hugely. One of the outrageous things at the time was that many of the CEOs and the people who worked in these banks got huge bonuses. They got huge bonuses for trashing the economy. They trashed the economy, and then they got rewarded for trashing the economy.
Thanks.
Okay, if there are no further questions, we'd like to thank you all for coming. I've just been told we have to be out of here by 5:30. So we're not kicking you out, but we have to be out by 5:30. And can someone hold up their copy of this Naturalmente Orgánico magazine just to show the others? Just hold it up. Okay, that magazine will be available outside. It has a biography of Dr. Banks towards the back of the magazine, and they're distributing free copies outside the auditorium.
Thank you all for coming.